This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 324, Summer. Oh my gosh. Of the Outlander podcast, I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
Of course.
And we're in love with all things Outlander.
I mean, I don't think it's changed yet. It's been, we're a little nutso. We're a little nutso. Maybe we need to change that tagline. We're a little knuck and futz for Outlander.
I would say that you're knuck and futz. I would say that I enjoy it and hang out with you.
You stop it. Why would you say I'm knuck and futz and you're not?
Because I know you.
Well, okay, aside from Outlander, that's different. For Outlander itself.
I mean, I think show of hands.
Between the two of us?
Show of virtual hands, listeners.
Yeah.
If we had to pick between the two of us.
Oh, Summer.
Between Shimmer and Toots, who would you say is more knuck and futz? About Outlander.
I think we have to name this episode Knuck and Futz.
Go ahead.
This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. Help support content you believe in. Content that was created for you, the Outlander friend or fanatic. To find out more, please visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon. And a special thanks to this week's co-producer, Jillian G. Okay, so... I get to say it this time. Do we have any announcements, Summer?
There's no like show and like Outlander show announcements really. However, there is our, because I was like, there's no show related announcements. But if we talk about our show, there's show related announcements. This is the last episode of the Fiery Cross read along, you guys. The last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chapters of the Fiery Cross.
We're going to shove it all in there.
That's what he said. So that being said, we are just 2 weeks away from episode 1 of season 6 of Outlander, which will be based on the book we are finishing tonight, The Fiery Cross. And I believe they are sprinkling in some things from some other books as well. But predominantly, this is the year of the Fiery Cross. And I'm going to let y'all in on a little behind the scenes stuff. Your girls, and by your girls, I mean,
are we telling this?
I mean, me and Mitz Toots over there.
Knuck and butts to you.
we are going to the Los Angeles premiere. So hopefully we'll be able to take you guys along to see a little bit of what it's like. We'll make it entertaining.
We're driving down there. So we're leaving quite early in the mañana.
I'm driving. She's riding.
And we're leaving crazy town early.
Our East Coast friends, what they have a hard time remembering is that almost the entire Western seaboard of the continental United States is California. So whereas
it's like Florida up to New York, right? Or not quite. A little less.
But the point is that for us, where we are in Northern California, to get down to Los Angeles in Southern California, it's a good 7 to 8 hours, depending upon traffic. And with traffic, it could be even longer. So the idea is we got to leave soups early on Thursday to get down there. Early enough to still have time to wash the car off of our bodies and get dressed and go to the premiere.
Yes, correct. And so what we'll do is it'll be early, but we're not going to be like calling anyone. Don't worry. We'll not wake you up. But unless you want to wake up with us. But what we'll do is we will, since Summer will be driving and I will have my hot little fingers free, I will be taking you guys along for the ride.
Well, not the whole ride, but
no,
it won't be
a seven hour
feed. It won't be a 7 hour live.
No,
on Instagram.
But we'll do some Instagram. Probably stories are the easiest, right? Because they're short clips of videos, and they don't take up your space in your, like, you know, your post feed. So to me, Instagram stories are the way to go, like if you're traveling or something. And so we will do that on Instagram. No one, if you follow us, or even if you don't follow us, you can find us at Outlander Pod. However, if there's anything like special announcements or whatevs, it's going to be to our Instagram close friends.
All right, Ginger, this Instagram close friends. How does one become an Instagram close friend?
It is nothing easier. You go to outlanderpod.com/Patreon. You become a supporter on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. And that's it. And then you have to let us know, because we don't obviously automatically know what your Instagram handle is. But if you, there's a post, once you become a supporter, you will see the posts, all the posts, they're hidden from non-supporters, but you'll see a post from a few months back that says, put your Instagram handle here. We'll get a notification and we'll add you and confirm it right away, or sometime as soon as we can. Look, I'm going to be in the car. So if you guys, she's going to be driving between now and then. We still have almost 2 weeks. So there's still time. But so to go behind the scenes with us, we will share a lot of it with just anyone, you know, our feed and our stories. But if there's anything, any little mini announcements we have or anything like that, it will go to our Instagram close friends. And to become an Instagram close friend, you simply support us on Patreon for as little as $1 a month.
And guys, we're going to have 7 hours strapped with each other in the car. So if you guys can come up with questions or things you want to ask us or anything to help entertain us while we're driving this monotonous drive.
Okay, I will put this out there. So we will take you along for the drive. And you might get a peek at, I mean, not that we're all that, but you might get a peek at us. You might not, but we'll definitely, like, you'll hear us. We'll talk and we'll show you guys stuff or whatever. However, to get us, like, you know, speaking to the camera or talking to each other, like, you know, like being a little more personable, I guess you could say, that's going to be close friends. That's going to be close friends. But even if you're not a supporter, not a close friend, we will take you along for the ride. While we're at it, before we go on to the next announcement.
Well, that leads to, it's the one more segue. So it's like the one more thing that's happening. So as we are segueing away from the read-along into the next section, or not section, that's not what I want to say. As we segue into the next phase. So, you know, as everyone who listens knows, we go read along. And then when the read along's over, you know, we're not doing a read along during the season when it's airing. So we're moving into our episode recaps. And our episode recaps will be starting, should be Sunday. We should be releasing that right after the episode premieres on Stars.
It'll be later that evening, correct?
And that also heralds the return of our live after shows. Ginger, where can they find our live after shows?
Well, we are still trying to work with some tech and decide if we're going to keep it in the group or do it on our Facebook page. Before we start sharing links and publicizing and promoting that, we will let you know. So that's our live after show. In case you haven't joined us for one of those, basically, we do, as far as I know, the only truly live after show, not only live, but also right after the show ends, because, I mean, it's in all different time zones. We go by the East Coast, though we are on the West Coast, but we go by the East Coast showing, which is at 8 p.m. Eastern. That's 5 p.m. Pacific. So an hour later, 9 p.m. Eastern. So the show ends on the East Coast, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We want to give you guys a few minutes to go to the bathroom, grab a snack, grab a drink, change, you know, dry your eyes. Who knows what's going to happen in the episode? Whatever you need to do. And then come meet us in our space, wherever that will be. We will provide links everywhere for 6:10 to 7:10 p.m. Pacific, 9:10 to 10:10 p.m. Eastern. And we will have our live after show. And so not only do we want you to join us for that, we have decided, just to streamline things a little bit more, we really, really, really want to encourage people to come to our live after show. If you cannot make it live, the video stays up. There's no problem. You can do a watch party. You can watch it on your own. You can fast forward through it. We hope to maybe, no promises, we hope to maybe have a rando guest. And and by the way, our co-producers on Patreon, who are those who support us at $10 a month, or no, there is no more, $10 a month. We're very thankful for them. And one of their bonuses is they get to join us on screen during our live after show. So during the season airing.
Now, you don't have to if you don't want to. We make it available.
Correct.
So don't be intimidated. No one's going to make you do anything, but we want to offer it to you if you want to come and play.
So that's new. We're offering that opportunity to those of you who would like to join us on camera for, you know, just a few minutes, just to give your, you know, to give your impassioned opinion, whether you love something or whether you really disagreed with the choice, or whether you disagree with me or disagree with Summer or you agree with us, whatever it is, you can come on camera and give it to us, you know?
No one ever disagrees with me. That's silly.
But we want to hear from you guys. Now, the flip side of that coin is, because we want to involve you guys, the flip side of that coin, however, is that we will not be having voice feedback on the season's shows, on our episode discussions. Now, the reason for that is, number one, we want to really amplify and use the live after show as just making it even more special and more, we're not saying it's a spectacular piece of television or anything.
No, but it's more of an interaction. We really want to interact.
Exactly. And we really want to put our energy into that. Number one. Number two, the feedback is always a week delayed. Now, that's okay in general, in that it gives you guys time to respond. There's no problem with that, but it's always slightly disjointed, right? And so when you listen to, not episode one, but our discussion of episode two, we're spending a half an hour or sometimes longer on the feedback, which we love. We are not anti-feedback. We want to hear from you, but we're spending so much time on the feedback before we even get to the main show. And it makes our shows, I think everything is like over 2 hours, right? I mean, they're incredibly long. Not that we can't ever be long, but you know, y'all know what I mean. So to recap, we're still doing our live after show. It will be from 6:10 to 7:10 p.m. Pacific, 9:10 to 10:10 p.m. Eastern, right after a potty, snack, water break, whatever you want to get, after we finish the East Coast premiere of each episode. And if there's any change, like if we're traveling or something happens, we will let you guys know in plenty of time in advance, because there, you know, life happens. We have some stuff coming up that will take you along with us too. We're doing our best to amplify and make our live after shows really, really special. I've already identified a number of things, just little tiny little tchotchkes, but little things we want to have, like before, at least one giveaway per after show. So we, like I said, we really want to make these things special for you guys and for us, because we love it. We have a great time. And that was to recap number one. And number two, we will no longer be doing voice feedback for our episode discussions while the season is on. But if you can't make one of the live after shows, like I said, you guys can still do the watch party. And people did this before. Like, we would come on 2 days later and we'd have 30 more comments. So believe me, it is not new, that the fact that people come on and watch our live after show, just not live. It's fun. We have such a good time. So if you have any ideas or ways we can even improve upon that, please let us know. As always, you can contact us on social media. We are at OutlanderPod everywheres. And you can email us. That might be the easiest. hello@outlanderpod.com.
And that is that. And on to our read-along. This week, as I said, we are winding down. Which is it? Winding up or down? Winding up?
Down. Winding down.
Okay. We are. That sounds weird. It just sounds weird to me. We are finishing our The Fiery Cross read-along. The next book, as I'm sure you all know, because you are all Diana Gabaldon fans, is A Breath of Snow and Ashes. And I know we teased it online. I have completed the sign-up sheet. We'll probably put it up Monday,
March 30th.
So pay attention on our Facebook group page. Monday, March 30th, we will be opening up and releasing the sign-up sheet to allow our contributors to select their chapters they want to be a part of.
And y'all, this is the book of the books. I mean, outside of Outlander, and I know I love number two, of course, but oh, baby.
It's a long one, too. Yeah. It's so funny because her chapter titles mean something. They always mean something. And as I'm putting the sheets together, the sign-up sheets together, and I'm re-going through and looking at the chapter titles, I'm remembering. I'm like, oh, that's the chapter when this happens, or oh, that's the chapter when that happens. And it's like, I haven't read this book in a while, so it was kind of refreshing to go back through and starting to get excited about reading it again. But that being said, let's start this week's read-along with chapter 106, entitled The Surgeon's Book 2.
July 27th, 1772. Claire documents a girdling injury of Rosamund Lindsay. Long story short, she got an infection and died.
Well, I mean, I'm like, come on. There was a little more that happened with that. Now, I have a question for you. I know that you haven't said anything about the chapter yet, but this is just the first time somebody dies of this, right?
In Claire's care, yes.
Okay. But it happens again in future books, right? Because I remember it happening later.
I don't remember it, but it's possible.
I feel like I remember the anaphylaxis happening again, but later.
It's possible. I don't remember.
I don't know.
It's possible.
Okay. That was it. I just didn't know if I was remembering correctly or not.
So she got an infection in her thumb. Like her thumb was almost cut off. And it had gotten bad enough that Claire was like, you know, we're going to have to amputate your arm to save your life. And the woman's like, nope. She wouldn't let her.
She's like, no, just cut open a pigeon and tie it on there.
But Claire doesn't really think that Rosamund died of septicemia. Even though she would have eventually anyway, she had it. But Claire believes that she died of a reaction to unpurified penicillin.
Anaphylaxis.
That's your throat closing up, right? You're an allergic reaction.
Well, she's that's what she's saying. She's allergic to penicillin.
But whether it's purified or unpurified will still kill you. It's just, she just happens to be having a reaction to unpurified because Claire really can't purify it. She can only do her best at collection and straining and all that.
Well, but this is how the scientist goes about learning which strains, because she's creating penicillin or cultivating it on a number of different rotting foods. So it's nice to, I mean, it's, I'm sorry for
Rosamund,
whatever her name was, that one. I'm sorry for her that she died, but that was very helpful. Maybe to Claire saying maybe it wasn't anaphylaxis from the just being allergic to penicillin in general, but if it was anaphylaxis due to the particular strain of penicillin that came off of a melon or whatever it was that
would
she
be
grew
a question for a doctor. I don't know if I truly don't know.
You need error. Move forward. That's my point.
Absolutely.
That's the only way you learn is by making mistakes. So it's like she needs to have missteps.
Yes, and
to
Claire
learn things.
Definitely was concerned about having, I don't know, not done. She has a discussion later on with Brianna, and she says there's nothing else she could have done. She treated the septicemia the best she could. She tried to amputate her arm to save her life. She said no. And she gave her the best she had, which was her penicillin. And it could have been something wrong with the penicillin, like she said, unpurified. It could have been the fact that she would have had anaphylaxis, even if it was the best penicillin on earth. You know what I mean? So we don't really know. There's a number of factors. But either way, she would have died no matter what from septicemia. But yeah, definitely ultimately her death before septicemia could kill her was from anaphylaxis. So we learn a little bit about Rosamund. She'd been a hoor in Boston, but she's gotten too stout and too old to ply her trade, so she went south looking for a husband. She met and married Kenny Lindsay, and Claire, or Diana, describes them as not having more than six teeth between them. It was not a love match, but she believes that they had grown friendly and grown, you know, to respect each other. So she had married Kenny Lindsay. Now, Claire, the reason this is called The Surgeon's Book, Claire is writing in the book, as she normally does, the account of what happened, who she sees, what she does, and what the outcome is. And so this is obviously, she's having a hard time. She's not having a hard time thinking that she needs to write the truth. That's her, that's what she, it, her gut is, that's what her gut is telling her. But she's been down this road almost being executed as a witch before. She does not ever, and she will never forget Cranesmere. She doesn't want to do that again. So she has to balance her training as a doctor, what she truly wants to leave behind so that someone could benefit from her experience, from her knowledge, from her practice, from her errors, as well as not leaving, willingly leaving behind crumbs so someone could find her and have her executed. So it's a little rough for Claire, but in the end, quote, "I won't last forever, so I'll write it all down," unquote. She needs to find someone to whom she can pass on her knowledge. That right there sets us up for the next book. Would you agree, Sam?
The book? This whole book sets us up for the next book.
Don't be obtuse. What I just said, Claire needs to find someone to whom she can pass on her knowledge. A very specific storyline is being set up right there.
Yeah, and it's already being used in this season.
Has it? Oh, well,
it's being hinted at that she needs to find somebody to work with her because she can't do it all by herself. It's in the trailers.
As a fashion, we don't know if it's the same storyline or just using someone instead of another story. You know what I mean? Mm. We don't know. We don't know. But yes, you're right. You're right. They've definitely hinted at it, at her needing help no matter what. So unfortunately, this person is not Brianna. She's not squeamish. She would be great. She would have the skill, but she doesn't really have a bent for healing. It's just not her.
It's not her thing.
Yeah. The men were coming down off the mountain. She can hear them. They're singing. And they're chanting, I'm going to try and pronounce it correctly, a Caithris or a Caithris for Rosamond. So she wasn't Scottish, but, or even a believer, I believe. But they do it because she had become part of their community. And that's some kind of, I don't know, I guess a chant for the dead or a chant for someone you're remembering. And as Bree is massaging Claire's shoulders, she's tight. I mean, Claire is tight, but she's massaging her shoulders, you know, after she basically was doctoring, attentive to her patient to the last. And she was there for a little bit over a day and she didn't have much sleep. So she's very sore and tired, and Bree is massaging her shoulders. And she tells her she thinks that she actually killed Rosamond. Now, Bree shares what Uncle Joe had told her. The way, I thought it was really interesting. And when I first heard it, I was like, oh, how is this going to make her feel better? But I understood what she meant. And she said Uncle Joe had told her that the way hospitals held formal inquiries when a patient died or something happened and the doctor may or may not have been at fault.
They used to do this on House all the time.
Yes. And these inquiries, these hearings, if you will, non-legal hearings, could be a sort of catharsis for the doctor. They went through, talked about what happened step by step, treatment, et cetera, choices made, and just to see like how they could do better. I'm sure there are inquiries that, you know, got people in trouble too, or, you know, reprimanded, whatever. But in many cases, at least the way that Uncle Joe had explained it to Bree, the way she understood it was that these formal inquiries gave the doctors a chance to kind of relive it and get support from others who knew what they were going for and who could tell them you did everything you were supposed to do, you know, who could reassure them and allow them that space to go through this in a way kind and mourn as needed. It's an institutionalized way of having this, a sort of catharsis at least. And she's sharing that because she realizes her mom does not have that. No matter how much she loves Jamie and Bree and Roger and Jemmy, Claire is, especially as a doctor, right? She is, Claire is still Claire's still a bit alone in some or many ways.
In the way that we're all alone. I mean, Roger's alone. Bree's alone.
That's true. Yeah.
Jamie's alone. They're all alone. Everyone's alone. No one's experience is exactly the same as anybody else's.
Yes, but that's true for every single person on the earth.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying.
She is not only alone as she has Roger and Bree, right, who are also TT. She has Roger and Bree. In that respect, she's not alone any longer as a time traveler. She is alone, however, as someone out of her time, complicated with or compounded by the fact that she is a 20th century trained surgeon. And something has just happened that she believes she caused or brought on sooner than would have happened naturally. And she does not have that natural institutionalized potential catharsis that is there for doctors. And so in that, she doesn't have anyone really who understands what she is going through. Bree is probably the closest because, you know, she knows her mom. She grew up around the hospital and doctors and all that. So anyhoozle, before going up for an hour's sleep, she writes her additional lines in the book. So we don't know exactly what she wrote, or maybe I just didn't write it down.
I'm pretty sure she wrote down anaphylaxis. She died from taking penicillin. That's what I took away from it. She wrote everything down instead of holding it back in case somebody found it and accused her of being a witch. She wrote it all down for the future generation.
Yes. What I'm saying is, I believe she wrote that. What I'm saying is, I don't know if she wrote that she believed she was at fault.
I'm sure she did, because they were the lines that must be there for the sake of the unknown physician who would follow me. I think it's important I think she thinks it's important that these people, whoever reads it or who learns from her later, knows that what killed Rosamond, while ultimately it would have been the infection, what actually killed her was something else.
And that
was chapter 106. Moving on to chapter 107,
Zug und Ruhe, maybe. Close enough.
That's pretty good. When you first announced it last week, I was like, I thought it was, because I wasn't looking at it, I was just listening to it. I thought you were trying to say Zug und Ruhe.
No.
But it's all one word. So yeah, Zug und Ruhe is, I think Diana says it is, or I looked it up too. It's migratory, I guess I did, migratory restlessness.
Or like ennui.
Well, wouldn't you have had to have something before you could feel ennui, or no?
Let me double check, because ennui to me is always like just the need to move forward. Hang on. It's a feeling of listlessness and dissatisfaction arising from a lack of occupation or excitement. So not ennui. It's not migratory in nature at all.
Okay. So it's September 1772. What was the date of the last one? Did I write down? Okay, July. So we're the same year. Now we're at 2 months later. Claire wakes up from a dream. She's having a heat stroke. I mean, hot flashes. A little bit different.
But at least it was a sexy hot flash.
I mean, that's true. She throws open the window to see what was a clatter.
Wrong time of year.
That's true. I'm a few months early. She hears a child's cry, and she believes someone has entered the house, and it was Roger with Wee Jem. Now, she has thoughts about her ever-present shadow. Meaning the shadow that, you know, follows you around when you're outside. Was it a demon or was it guardian angel? This is not quite stream of consciousness, but it was close. And then she says or writes or thinks, the child that she had heard was now coughing, and she hears Roger singing Clementine to Jem. Jamie comes to the doorway and asks if she's well, and she says she's fine. And she has a seemingly random thought of Lawrence Stern. Remember Stern?
Yes.
She thinks of him and how he stank.
Yes.
But also at the same time smelled of expensive cologne. And Jamie, she says it's Jamie. And Jamie Jamie basically says, I can smell all the smells of you, Claire. He sits her in the windowsill and goes downtown, Judy Brown. And Jamie mentions Stern's theory of why birds sing at night. He'd done an experiment, Stern had. He'd found that birds seemed to be pulled in the direction of southeast, the direction they would eventually be migrating toward. And the experiment he did was with young birds who had not yet taken that journey. So that's really interesting and significant. And he called it Zugunruhe. Quote, the wakefulness of the wee birds getting ready to leave on their long flight. Unquote. And also, quote, restlessness, the uneasiness before a long journey. Unquote. What did you, that was almost like a, I don't even know. What did you think about that chapter?
Because honestly, the thing I remembered the most about this chapter was Roger kind of singing his, in his version of singing to the baby as he walked away. And then Claire and Jamie doing it in the window. That's what I remember from this chapter.
I just have this thought that, I mean, I guess it's too late now because it hasn't happened, y'all. We've read book 8 and it hasn't happened. Some point, someone, and I think Thomas Christie, but that's wrong because it doesn't happen. I just have this thought that she's up there doing that. Even if she's safe and not fallen, she's, I think she's buck naked or at least whatever. Maybe she's in her shift. But I just imagine someone walking down the ridge at night, looks up and sees that going on in the window. And I just have this idea that we're going to, later on down the road, someone's going to say, I saw you one night. Yeah, I doubt it, but you never know.
They could. Everyone of that time period seems to be real good at just turning the other way. Like, you have to imagine how many of these families have one-room homes.
No, that's true.
Yeah, but one-room homes where your kids are sleeping in the same room, sometimes the same bed, I don't know. I'm just saying, you get... There is something about that time period because of necessity, everyone just kind of, you know, turning their back. Like when Jamie and her were doing it in the campfire in the first book, everyone knew they were just turning their backs. So, I mean, it's just, I think no one would mention it. Except maybe Bree, if she happened to catch it. And it would be like a mother. And that is 107, moving right along to 108, Tulach-Ard. And it was weird because Davina, for whatever reason, decided now this book, she was going to say Tulach-Ard.
And actually, that's more correct than Tulach-Ard because the D, and I think even end Ds, are J.
Yes. Well, we'll just keep saying to the car and we're good.
Yes. Now, a month later-ish, October 1772, Jamie and Roger and Jem are a-hiking. Well, at least they're starting to hike out towards the thing. And Jem is wanting to go with them. But the two men say, yeah, no. And they want to take him back to his mom. Lizzie and Bree and all the ladies were worried about where he was. You could hear them, you know, yelling for him. And the calls are beginning to have a little bit of the sound of panic in them. Kate O. writes, quote, the small redhead shook in vehement negation, unquote. I laugh every time I read this excerpt with both Jamie and Roger fighting equally losing battles with wee Jemmy. The little redhead is just as stubborn as his grandfather and father, not to mention his mother and grandmother. So this is hard for Roger, right? It's the first time Jem has wanted to be with him so strongly and not his mom. Whatever the reason. So they decide to take him for about a half a day. And they're going to build hog pens, by the way. So Jamie agrees to go back to the house to let the women know that they've got Jem. He's safe. And while they wait, Roger, they have a little chat about going to the bathroom. And Roger takes him over to a bush or something to relieve himself. Jamie comes back with goodies. And apparently, he's stolen them. Kate O. writes, I'd like to entitle this part of the chapter, Jamie Fraser's Thoughts on How to Handle Women, unquote. Because they were talking about how one of the things they were talking about, or I think Roger said, or maybe Diana just wrote, is that how Jamie could, this is true, Jamie could do no wrong in Mrs. Bugs' eyes. And he got away with anything.
Is anyone worried about the fact that he had dripping melted butter and honey biscuits stuffed in his shirt? That just sounds like messy. There's a lot of things that I've smuggled in my bra. A drippy, gooey biscuit is not one of those things. cell keys. Phones, credit cards, cash, keys, all kinds of things that I've smuggled in my bra. I've never, ever buttery, gooey honey biscuit.
Who knows how much longer later than this. They are getting the pens closer to being built. And Roger is trying to move or planning to move a big stone. And as he's holding this big stone, Jem brings his attention to a big pig. Of course, it's a piggy. Yep. It's, of course, piggy. A boar. A large, I believe they said a male boar. He tells Jem to get behind him. And he tells him to look around for Jamie. And when Jem yells for Jamie, the pig goes on alert. And Roger tells him it's time to run to Granddad. He tells him to run. Roger throws the stone at the pig and then basically jumps on it. So, yes, as you do.
As you do.
As he's knocked down, he is injured. And then he hears Tullaharge come screaming into the scene. It's Jamie with his dirk. And Roger's like, with a dirk? You have a small pointy needle? He gets Roger a stick to use as a spear. And then yells, Tullaharge, come here, you fat effer. Of course, he doesn't say effer. That's just what I mean. Lots of fighting and stabbing later. Jem comes out running at the pig with a dirk. Oh, Lord have mercy.
Well, do as you see. That's what he learned.
And Roger dives in to grab him, and he sees like a flurry, I can't think of the word, not a smear, like in his periphery, who knows where, either periphery or straight ahead, but in his field of vision, he sees, yes.
He sees a flicker of movement from the woods beyond Jemmy.
Or strikes of, the flicker of movement he sees is gray, and he thinks, oh no, wolves.
He sees a streak of gray.
And then at this point, the boar falls, and all are astonished at the arrow sticking out of its side.
I wasn't.
I was.
I knew it was coming.
I forgot this is how he came back. I thought he came back in a different way. I didn't know. This is awesome.
I think he does again.
Let me ask you this. So I am putting the weight of the show on your tongue.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay.
Do you think? Because this is like pretty, this is full of action, right? This is not sitting down. This is not quiet. This is full of action. Do you think they'll have Ian return this way?
Yeah. Well,
if it's not a boar, he'll return some way with an arrow. I think it's just too awesome to not keep.
I'm just saying. It might not be a boar, but there will be some stramash
in
the woods.
I hope so.
I can feel it. I mean, you can't write better than this. You can't. You literally couldn't make this more exciting.
Kate O writes, as soon as the boar appears, all I can think every time is Roger finally gets to take Jemmy out on a boys-only excursion. And as usual, the worst possible thing that could happen does. Quote, and with the feeling that wolves on top of pigs was patently unfair. Unquote.
Anytime Roger goes anywhere by himself, something awful happens to him, because I think he is Diana Gabaldon's favorite foil. I think she likes torturing him the most. I know she tortures everybody. Everyone gets a little bit, but he gets it all the time, the whole time, all the time. I don't think he gets breaks.
Uh-huh.
But welcome back to young Ian.
They look upon the Native American and the wolf. It was young Ian. Young Ian is back.
Whoop, whoop.
And of course, Rollo. Aww. Kate O writes, even on the first read through, I had thought that even though this is Roger, a pack of wolves in addition to a wild boar is just ridiculous. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew that the wolf just had to be Rollo. And even with knowing it's Ian, I still break out in a huge smile every time I read, oh, Christ, it's Ian.
And that was the last short chapter for a while. Moving on to chapter 109. Get comfortable, y'all. The Voice of Time.
This is a big one, yeah.
This is the Grange chapter. I call it Grange.
Not quite as bad as the Grange chapter we just had with Bonnet telling everything about everything.
No, it's not. But while I find the idea of Ottertooth interesting,
I enjoyed him just as much as a man of mystery as I do now that he's been fleshed out a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So while I find it, they may or may not add this. That's why I'm like, I almost prefer him as a man of mystery as opposed to the truth of what he is, because we all kind of assumed that's what he was doing anyway from the last book. That was the whole point, was to come back and stop. But this was just kind of like confirmation of what we all were hinted at in the last book.
Okay, let's go there without spoiling. So we know they have Ottertooth because they have the skull, right? They've already buried it. Like, that's done. And the insinuation that it was, or whatever, that it was a time traveler because of the teeth. And the filling. The Tikaba. And they have it, right? They have the pearl. They have the opal now, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So all of that. So again, I'm just going to say this because I'm a little bit early, but the whole thing, and we'll get to it in the last chapter or next to the last chapter, I think it is this chapter. The whole thing about the exploding opal, that is also freaking like great, great writing in that it's still action, right? It's something dangerous. It's drama. It's dramatic. It's potentially dangerous, but who could have gotten slashed? And it's a very dramatic and visual way for readers to find out that Jem is probably crazy more TT than even everyone else we know.
I mean, it goes back and fills in why he may or may not have blisters on his mouth from swallowing that sapphire.
Yes, ma'am. Okay, prepping Lizzie for Mawaj. Some women on the ridge were working together to get her fitted out because they don't have a lot of stuff. And of course, she's betrothed to whom, Sama? Whom?
Manfred
McGillivray. Correct. They're doing it in the kitchen with good light. All this sewing.
What are they doing?
Stop it.
They're doing it in the kitchen with good light.
Basically quilting. Into this quilting circle comes Jamie and gets Claire's attention. When she goes out, she sees young Ian and Rollo, and they're hugging and she's crying, and Jemmy bursts in to see Rollo, and then Bree comes out, sees everything, and Ian kisses her. And then Roger shows up, scraped his face, I think his forehead. What have they been up to, dude? Not much, but we do have a hog for you, by the way. And Ian, how long are you back for?
For good.
He has come home. I can't wait. That's going to be a great. Do you think? Okay, let me ask you this. Since we've gone through the whole book now,
not together,
we don't find out a lot in this book because now that we've finished reading it, we don't find out a lot in this book. We find out more later. It's not a spoiler. Mm-hmm. It's because we're not going to say what it is. But we find out more later about Ian and his time with the Mohawk in the next book, right?
Correct.
But the last thing we knew or heard from this book is that they got a page. Ironically, from this same book, a blank page. They got a page from this book that he was able to write a note on to have sent to them, saying that he was okay, he was alive, he was married in after the Mohawk fashion, and he had a child on the way. Right, mm-hmm. That's all they knew. And then Jamie sent it on to Jenny, and they tell him this. They tell him this in this chapter, and then he comes back here at the very end, and they know nothing. They only know that he's back and he's here to stay. They have not told us anything in this book about what happened with his time in the Mohawk. We find out more later. So my question is, Summer, exactly, do you think they're going to weave, number one, tell us something at the end, or you think they're going to weave Ian in and out of this entire season? I hope not. I think it makes more drama for him not to be seen at all.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to show it, because if they show it, then he doesn't get a surprise return.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you think it'll be like a big surprise at the end or near the end?
I think so. I don't think John Bell's been doing a lot of filming.
I hope not. I hope they keep it. I'm not saying it has to be by the book. No, but I hope they keep it. Meaning keep him, his character, away for a good amount of time, and then I hope he comes back, and obviously comes back with that kind of action move. Oh my gosh, that would be amazing. But yeah, I hope he stays away and that we don't get him intertwined, because I want it to be dramatic and amazing. So they're all wondering what had happened to his wife and child, but he's not given any news. He's not given anything information away. So Lizzie seemed to be extra excited about Ian returning. Ha ha. They set him to bed. send him. He didn't send him. They set him up for bed in the surgery and they leave the window open so Rollo can come and go as he likes, but they take Adso to the bedroom to protect him, or maybe to protect Rollo. Ian's face was deeply tanned, quote, with the dotted lines of his Mohawk tattoos. They ran in fierce crescents from nose to cheekbones, unquote. Now, I'm not complaining. I'm just making an observation. Unlike in the book, in book four, when he, you know, they were going to rescue Roger and Ian, you know, volunteered himself to stay in his place. But the time in the book, by the time they came forward and he's like, no, I'm doing this. He was already shaved. And he already had his tattoos. Like, it was that quick.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do it, which I thought, you know, it's a lot. It's kind of hard to believe that happened. It would have happened that quickly. Not that it couldn't have, but whatever. So since they didn't do it, do you think when he shows up, he's going to be tan and have, or at least have tattoos?
The only thing I can speak of is the fact that the actor has had a shaved, shiny shaved head for a while now. So
I don't know. I think they will do tattoos, and the reason I think that is because they have spent so much time on Jamie's back that I can't see them not doing the tattoos. And it's such a part of his persona moving forward in the book series because it makes him other to his own people.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. They don't have to, obviously, but I hope they at least, even if they don't do, you know, make him like deeply tanned. I don't know, because he's like me. He's a white boy. I'm a white girl. He's very fair. So he'd have to get like fake tan if they tanned him. Ian brings out a leather-bound book and he mentions the page he'd used to get a note out to them that he was okay. It was the journal of a time traveler, a journal of a successful trip through a stone circle or through an area. He doesn't say there were stones. He says that they lay a circle. I looked and the only stones they mentioned were actual gems. So I read that quite carefully to make sure I didn't miss, and I could have made a mistake, but I believe he didn't mention a stone circle. He mentioned there were five of them that each had a stone and they had laid the circle with herbs or whatever they were doing. There's a reference to a Raymond and to a sapphire that had burned up during his travel. And the writing had not been done by a quill, but rather a ballpoint pen. There was a list of names. And these names were in Mohawk, but the Mohawk didn't have a writing system at that time. So it was written in English or maybe Latin, I don't know, English or Roman. They were Romanized. They were in a Roman script, so in an alphabet that looks like ours. But the sounds they made were Mohawk. They are described by their name and which stone they carried, and the description of how they laid the points of the circle, as I said. Michael M. writes, he calls this, Dear Diary. Ian has with him the journal of one Robert Springer, a.k.a. Ottertooth, and member of the Montauk Five. A lead guitar, maybe? This tome provides a wealth of information that expands our collective knowledge of time travel. They're all kind of gathered around, and after Jamie translates the text, some of it. Ian's eyes were on Claire, quote, soft brown and full of speculation, unquote. And she answers, quote, yes, I am. Brianna and Roger too, unquote.
Uh-oh.
Ian now knows foe de show, and they confirm it. And then he says, quote, I knew you weren't a fairy, Auntie Claire. Unquote. Oh, Lord have mercy. So I think it's still the afternoon, but after the house retires to bed, Jamie continues. Well, actually, they're all together. He continues the translation. The dude, so this Ottertooth dude, he couldn't find any of his friends after he woke up or came to after going through the circle or going through the, after traveling. One of the Mohawk who had given Ian the book asked them to take it to Claire. It had belonged to a man, as Michael M. referred to, named Ottertooth. The woman who gave it to Ian to give to Claire referred to it, or him, as one of Claire's family, which kind of makes sense. So Ottertooth was not much of a hunter, but he could recognize some plants. So he was able to survive for a little bit, at least, by eating persimmons and nuts, berries, who knows.
I wouldn't like that.
After he, Huh?
I'm with Jamie on the persimmons.
Ugh.
I don't like to eat them.
I like the cookies only.
I know. I like them in cookie form, but I don't. And I've tried them all. There are like several different types of persimmons. There's the eating kind, and then there's the baking kind. And the baking kind are like the they look kind of like hearts. They come to a point at the bottom. And then the flat ones, I think they're fuyu or fugu, or starts with an F and ends with a U. And they're like squat. They look like tomatoes. And those ones, they're sweet. And those ones you eat when they're hard and they're crisp. And they're supposed to resemble kind of an apple thing. I did not think that it tasted like an apple, but I did enjoy cooking it. But the other ones, the ones that are shaped kind of like a heart, and I don't mean like the shape of a heart. I mean like a human heart. They kind of, they taper to kind of a big top, and then they taper to a point at the bottom. Those you don't eat until they are like super soft and squishy. That's when they get sweet. They're kind of like bananas in that way. That's a little persimmon info for you.
Yeah, you have to make me some persimmon cookies or something, girl.
Did you miss the last batch I made?
Apparently, yes. Oh, make some more.
They were good. No, you had them. I made them at Christmas. They were at Christmas.
Did I try one? I don't even know.
They were on the cookie platter. I don't know what you did.
I did not have everything on the cookie platter. And by everything, I don't mean I ate it all. I mean, I did not try one of everything. No. If I had eaten everything on the cookie platter, I would have been in a diabetic coma, because it was a lot. It was really good, but oh, Lord have mercy, woman. We had a lot. But it wasn't just from you, right? It was from other parties and other stuff.
I'm just going to say it was all from me.
Oh, it was all from Summer. It was amazing.
I brought them. It doesn't matter where they came from before me.
So he survived for a bit anyway by foraging. And he wandered around like this until he found a village. He was upset that the people he found were using iron kettles, because this clued him in the fact that he was too late, or later than he had wanted or intended to arrive during to time travel to. 50 or more years too late. Now, as Claire goes to bed, they all get ready for bed. She thinks about how comfortable she is in her life with Jamie, but also remembers the loss of the world that she'd been into. So while, yes, they learn information from Otter Tooth and his experience and all this stuff, at its core, it's an interesting chapter, because you learn about Jem, we learn more about time travel and everything. But it's also kind of a, not desperate, but kind of a, I don't know if tragedy is the right word. It's a very stark and scary and sad tale of someone who had good intentions. He wanted to better the lives of thousands, if not millions of, ultimately, hopefully millions of people, you know, save a lot of lives, at least, if not change things outright. And number one, to not have been with anyone that he traveled with, like to realize that you were not only literally alone because your friends were either dead or in who knows where, or two things, the fact that you were literally alone, but also the fact that you were out of your own time and would never be going back. I mean, that's, you're more alone than anything. But yeah, so in general, I liked the chapter. It was interesting. It had, you know, we learned more information. But did you also have an idea of the stark desolation? I think that's the D word I was thinking. Like the desolation that you feel, right? Because there's like, you're alone and there's nothing. There's a world around you, but you're alone on behalf of Otter Tooth. And then Otter Tooth,
I was like, wait, what? I was like, where are we going with this?
No. Him. And then later on.
Yes. But at the same time, I was like, dude, calm down. It was worse for Claire. She didn't know she was going to do it. You sound like a whiny baby to me right now.
Later on in this chapter, Bree, either her hand is already on her mom's hand or she reaches over and touches her mom's hand.
She touches her mom hand?
Yes.
What is her other hand then? If she has a mom
she
hand?
She clutches herself. Is that better?
Well, no, but I want to know if Bree has one mom hand. And what is her other hand? Her dad hand? Her daughter hand?
Her daughter hand. She clutches her mom's hand. And specifically because although she knew the facts of what happened, she knew her mom fell through time, you know, not of her own volition, blah, blah, blah. But hearing Otter Tooth's account And it, he had chosen, and he still ended up in it with a really bad deal, right? Things still went like all kinds of sideways. She couldn't imagine. So he felt desolate and alone and everything. And he chose that. Claire, she, anyway, all that to say, she knew, or she understood a bit about what Ottertooth must have been feeling. And she's, and then she thought, how much more awful must it have been for my mom, who had no training, had no preparation, had no Raymond at that time.
Had no idea what happened.
Exactly. So yeah, that was, that would have been rough. Definitely. So the next afternoon, Jamie, Claire, Ian, and Brie, and Roger, and Jem gather in Jamie's study. Roger and Brianna are now in the know. Jem is playing wooden beads under the table. Jamie reads a portion that from the book that he'd marked. Ottertooth's name was Robert Springer. Brie remembers the name Springer. It had been in the newspapers. It had been a big deal in Boston. The Montauk Five, she remembers. They were AIM activists. Now, I don't know what that is, so I'll look that up real quick. American Indian Movement. Okay, this is interesting. There, from what I see, there is no Montauk Five. I mean, officially. But there is, according to Wikipedia, the Montauk Project is a conspiracy theory that alleges there were a series of secret United States government projects conducted at Camp Hero or Montauk Air Force Station in Montauk, New York, for the purpose of developing psychological warfare techniques and exotic research, including time travel. Can you believe it?
I'm positive that's not how they sold it to the government.
I'm just reading this. The story of the Montauk Project originated with the Montauk Project series of books by Preston Nichols, which intermixes those stories with stories about the Bulgarian experiment. So we will link to that. Not that Wikipedia is the be-all, end-all, but under the at the end of the article, it has a number of references and other external links. So we will share that in the show notes, which I got to send to myself. Hold on. I thought that was interesting. She explains it, Brianna does, to her family, the Montauk Five, and Jamie and Ian get a lesson in the 20th century status of the Native American. These men had been arrested, they'd gotten out of prison, and then disappeared. And one of the bodies, however, had been found. That was probably, they believe now that maybe it was one of the people who had not made it through the stones, who died.
If they found one and there were five, they did the testing and whatnot to test that they could hear it and whatever. What do we think happened to the other three? Do you think they scattered to the winds, to different timelines?
We know what happened to one. Then there are three up in the air. Ottertooth had first met Raymond at a naming ceremony. Claire jolts upon hearing this. Now, there is no description of Raymond.
You know what? I think everyone who read this book jolted when they read that.
Oh, yeah. Completely. Ottertooth had brought his friends to meet Raymond, and a plan was made. But first, there was a test. They did a test of apparently hundreds of people, not just his friends, but I swear I read or heard somewhere else that it had been like 200. But many had failed. He did not. As a matter of fact, five had not. So his plan had been to go to the Iroquois League to rouse them against white settlers. Now, as they're contemplating just what Ottertooth had gone through alone, Jem asks about the opal, and Claire gives it to him to play with. Ottertooth had written in Latin to hide the writing in case someone saw the book. Now, Ian restates that he was given the book to give to Claire, and Ian is sad about what is to happen to the natives. At this point, Jemmy raises his voice and says, "Hot, mummy, hot." Michael M. writes, "It's hot." Back in chapter 78, Jem first describes a stone, a raw sapphire, as being hot. After having a short conversation with an opal, Jem explains, "Hot, mummy, hot."
Only there weren't any blisters on his mouth this time.
Claire then hears a, quote, high-pitched ringing sound like a weird singing of a crystal goblet when you run a wet finger around the rim, unquote. Roger hears it too. Brie grabs Jemmy, and then there was a sound like a gunshot. The opal had exploded.
Jem is so lucky that sapphire didn't explode inside of his body.
Yeah, that's true. That could have been bye-bye, Jem.
I mean, it would have been a much shorter book and a much shorter series.
Not necessarily a shorter book. It would have been a shorter gem. Fragments of the opal were in the bookshelf, books, walls, Bree's skirt. It had hit Roger's ear, and Ian had been hit in the calf. Like, it was all everywhere. Duh fuzz. What the heck? Later, we learned that Claire hadn't sensed anything weird about the stone, and Jamie hadn't heard a noise.
Well, although she did. Claire was carrying that stone around for a while, and it's never done that for her.
No.
And it's never done that for anybody else who's touched it.
No.
So clearly,
Jem is a super TT.
Something. Right. And I think it's because he's got two dominant genes.
That's our guess. Yes. Because.
Gotta be. Because he's like the super traveler.
He's something. So Jamie asks Jem if he heard it, the stone. Yes. And he says, again, it was hot. They all take turns feeling a sliver of the opal. It's warm to the T-tiers and cool to the knots. By now, the big candle with the gemstones was melting.
Was melting? What?
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
By now, the big candle with the gemstones that Jamie had lit was melting, and you could begin to see the actual gems. Jamie pulls them out and wipes them off. And Jem feels them and says that they're hot. Bree tells Jem to drop it if they get really hot. Roger is watching this. And he's thinking, Jem's a TT, isn't he? Jem confirms the rock is singing to him. Now, Roger and Bree and Claire can't hear the stone, like explicitly hear, like, oh, yeah, I hear it right now. Claire thinks she can hear or feel like a vibration from it if she listens really hard, but she does not hear it overtly. Claire explains that TT must be genetic. And in trying to show that genetics is more than eye color and blood type, Claire puts out her rolled up tongue. And Jamie does. Ian could do it, but Roger couldn't. Claire gives another genetics lesson.
How many people immediately tried to see if they could roll their tongue?
I didn't, only because I was trying to get through it.
Well, I was listening to it in my car, and I'm driving down the freeway, and I'm like, oh, wait, can I do that? Because I think I can. Like, I was pretty sure I could. But as soon as they talked about it, I immediately stuck my tongue out rolled it like a taco.
Oh, yeah. Like a taco.
I always called it a tongue taco.
So Claire gives another lesson in genetics. Bree and Roger both cannot roll their tongue, which means that Claire and Jamie must both be big T. If, well, this is time travel. Sorry. If we call rolling,
I don't know
tongues,
what I thought you were going to say.
Big T.
Big T.
Big tits.
I was like, I don't know. I was like, big tits.
No, let's call tongue rolling capital R, little R. So if Brianna cannot, and both her parents can, it means both her parents must have passed on their recessive gene. So they must be big R. They each are both big R, little R. And she got two little R's from them. And Roger's also little R, but we don't, we don't know if his parents are big R, little R, or both also recessive. That's not as important, but it does tell us that he is our little R, little R, and she's little R. So,
and this particular portion of the chapter reminded me of when I was in high school and found out that I was the only member of my immediate family who is not O positive. So that's when I learned about recessive.
Yes. Yeah, so Summer is, you're negative, which means you're minus minus. And I am positive, and both of our parents are positive. So what we know what our parents are. I'm the oddball out. We don't know what I am. We know I express. I'm O positive.
You're very expressive.
Summer. Yes, I know that. But our parents are both O plus minus because they each had to give a minus to give to Summer because she's minus minus. That's the only way you can be negative or recessive. To express the recessive is to have two of them. So Summer is O negative. We're all O positive. What I don't know is there is a... Since I'm not, so our two parents coming together would be 25% of giving plus plus, 50% of plus minus, and 25% of minus minus. Summer got that. I am a positive, but we don't know if I'm plus plus or plus minus.
My daughter is definitely a plus minus.
Ah, well, that's true because she can only get it from you. Oh, and
yep.
Her father was a positive as
O
well?
Positive.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She's so positive.
If Bree and Roger can't roll their tongue, that means the only thing they could have passed on, I know she wasn't necessarily going there, but the only reason they couldn't, well, she was likening it to the time travel. The only thing they could have passed on to Jem would have been the recessive trait, which means as their child, he should not be able to. But that was kind of a sideways test of oopsie. So Jem catches, as in all of Claire's talk about eggs and testes and gametes and everything, Jem catches the word testes. And Roger says, it's just Latin for your balls. Ian.
I got balls?
Yeah. Ian suggests they go show him, Jem.
Well, because it's more than, because he doesn't know what he's talking about. Well,
exactly. And so Roger.
And how do you, he pointed it at Jemmy's crotch.
He cups him.
Yes. And he goes, and he's like, that's my willy.
Yes.
You're saying my balls are like my willy? So the only way for him to be able to understand what they were talking about is to show him the differential between the two.
So they take Roger. Jamie goes to take him and Roger out to show them. And on the way, Jamie unthinkingly asks Jem if he can roll his tongue.
Oop. And all of the air is sucked out of the room.
No pressure. Or is
literally
it under pressure?
Literally everyone in the room stops breathing and they're all just standing there like, what's he going to do?
Yep.
Can he do it? Can he do it?
After a time, Jamie passes it off to Roger like, sorry, dude. And after a time, Roger asks him to try the tongue thing. And he goes, bleh, it's flat.
Well, thank goodness. But they're still not out of the woods. It's only perpetuating the mystery.
Correct.
If he could roll it, he absolutely wouldn't be Rogers.
That's correct.
But because he can't roll, he still could be Bonnets.
Yes, because we don't know Bonnets status.
We're just milking this storyline for as many books as possible.
And you can't tell at all that, I mean, this is basic genetics, quite honestly, but it doesn't hurt to have, I mean, you do have a main character of all the books that is a nurse and then now a surgeon. So you got a scientist for all your life. So, you know, once Diana decided to go with the nurse turned surgeon, you knew science was never going to be leaving the books. And as well it shouldn't, because Diana probably was writing from a young age, but Diana was a scientist before she was at least an Outlander novelist.
Outlander?
Yes. I'm getting my...
Is that for the outdoor laundresses?
I'm getting my... Mom, I'm getting my Brazil on. No, I'm getting my Britain. I can't talk really. Yes, I'm done. Michael M. writes, Jem has balls, and we learn that testes is Latin for balls. Granddad got balls, he asked, pulling on the men's hands and tilting his head far back.
I was like, I don't remember that happening. Where was he putting the men's hands?
No. And tilting his head far back to look up at Jamie. Quote, I have, Jamie said dryly, but your da's are bigger. Come on then. Mm-hmm. That was funny.
I mean, do you know why he said that?
Yeah, because he had courage to do that in front of everybody.
Okay. Wait, to do what in front of everybody?
Seriously? To do a genetic test in front of everybody.
Okay. Just double checking, because this whole chapter is leading to him flashing his nuts. So,
and we miss it.
I didn't know if we were referring to... We don't. It's not. It's off page.
I don't need to see a little boy's nuts. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying I want to see that.
No. No one needs to see that.
No, I know.
All right. And that was chapter 109. Moving on to chapter 110, the penultimate chapter of The Fiery Cross, Man of Blood.
They have a remembrance ceremony to honor the five... fallen men.
Five. What is wrong with you? You really are going in European in your voice.
I was going to say fallen, and I said five. So I went five.
Five. The five. You're almost... No, that was almost Australian.
Oh, stop it. They have a remembrance ceremony to honor the five fallen men. And it was for Daniel Rawlings as well. Herbs that were sacred for the Tuscarora, Cherokee, and Mohawk were used. Jamie recites a Gaelic prayer. Ian continues the ceremony in Mohawk and then in English. And then Roger goes. So there's the Catholic Gael, the Mohawk, and a Protestant modern man. As they walk back to the house, Jamie asks Roger what their decision is or what they think now that they know Jem can travel. Roger's answer is that he thinks about the regulators and their loss of Herman Husband and how that might have affected them. How the revolution may have happened earlier, much earlier, and in a different spot, had it been better supported. Roger says, quote, "There are times for men of peace and a time for men of blood," unquote. He means to stand by Jamie's side, as he had been called to do at the gathering. So what will he and his family do? They will stay.
And Brianna let out the breath she was holding. I wonder if even she hadn't put it into words. You know what I mean?
About thinking about what they were going to do?
Yeah. Like if between the two of them, they'd never had not at that point made a decision, as in, I know they've discussed it separately amongst the two of them, and they may have argued and had different points of view. But until this moment, this might have been the moment when he finally was just like, no, we're staying. When he was giving his final, not his final answer, but, you know, the trajectory of the whole thing could change based on this conversation. So he could have said anything in that moment, even if they had previously decided one way or the other, he could have at that moment said either thing. Mm. So it was like that, whatever. Anywho. And finally, rounding up this year's read-along, we have the no longer the penultimate chapter. We have the ultimate chapter, chapter 111, the last chapter of The Fiery Cross, entitled, "And Yet Go Out to Meet It."
With their decision of staying, Jamie puts the stones back into the candle and lets it harden. Three stones are in the candle. The fourth was in a small wooden box on its way to Edinburgh to be sold and then taken to Ned Gowan for what purpose, Summer?
A couple of things. One, he's gonna sell it because he knows somebody who can sell it because he's got family. So he's gonna sell it for a good price. A portion of that is going to be his fee. And then for what he's prepared to do next, what he's asking him to do, which is to go out and find out if Lyra McKenzie is living in sin but not married and still collecting her alimony when she don't deserve it. And if she does have a man living in her house and living in a married way without being married, he's going to basically say, this contract is null and void per the clause we added in there. We're not paying you anymore. You clearly have a man. Or two, if she's not having carnal interactions with a man, then that money would go to pay towards Leary and also to be up for, I think, payment for Leary. So hopefully it would pay it completely out. I don't remember one way or the other. But then if it was, that extra money was supposed to go into a trust for a dowry for wee Joni. Is that all of it? Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's it. So there was no more choice about the future or sides. It was coming, and they would simply do their best. And then the last line of this book is a line probably one of the most beloved lines in all eight series. Mm. Eight books thus far.
One.
When the day shall come that we do part, if my last words are not, I love you, it was because I didna have time.
Cue the
exhale.
Worldwide sighing. The exhale for many reasons. One, for the great line.
Oh, yeah.
A fantastic line by Miss Diana Gabaldon. But also the sheer fact that they don't have to listen to me say the Fiery Cross read-along ever again.
Neither do I.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. And with that, that, my friends, is the end of The Fiery Cross. Join us next week. It will be a non-read-along week. But if you'd like to join us and talk more about the book and more about the series, you can go to our Facebook group page, which is at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a special thanks to co-producer of episode 324, Jillian G. Remember, you too can become a co-producer and get all of our episodes ad-free by supporting us on Patreon. Find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon. Well, that will do it. We have wrapped up our read-along of The Fiery Cross. And as Summer said, believe it or not, we have already begun prepping for you and for us, let's be honest, the sign-up sheet for A Breath of Snow and Ashes. Holy crap. That's one of the, it's one of the best books. Oof, oof, oof. As I love to say, it's the only book out of all eight or any of the big books thus far, because I'm happy for it to happen to all the rest of the books. It's the only book thus far for which Diana has won an international prize for fiction, and our beloved Davina Porter, the narrator, has also won the Audie Award for Best Narrator in Drama. So thank you guys so much for being a part of this, our fifth read-along, the longest one yet. Thank you for being with us here every step of the way, for supporting us, for listening, for subscribing in all of the different apps that you do, for following us on social media, and just being a part of this amazing community. And as Summer said, if you haven't joined our group, please do. We love and foster that community there. And also remember, as Summer teased earlier, we will be going to Los Angeles for a very special Outlander event in a few weeks. And we will take you along with us. And I guess that's all we have to say before I start repeating myself again. So thank you guys, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.